You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, another episode of The Brian Callen / Hunter Motz Show. We have none other than A.J. Jacobs, who is an author and also writes for one of my favorite magazines, actually your editor-at-large of Esquire. You've worked for the Antioch Daily Ledger and Entertainment Weekly. You do lots of lifestyle experiments. We are here to talk to you about your year of living biblically. You've spent a month doing your best not to lie at all. And we'll get into your current project in a little bit. AJ,
you grew some amazing facial hair.
Oh, dude. AJ Jacobs, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the mother of all podcasts.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you spent 1 year, and you've written a book about it, and you've done plenty of lectures about it. You spent a year trying to live biblically, I mean, like a true fundamentalist. And one of the things you always talk about is fundamentalists kind of, there's no such thing because they pick and choose. You tried to follow the letter of the law here. You lived the Old Testament, what the Old Testament said. Stone adulterers. Don't sit in a chair if a woman has sat in it and she's been menstruating. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And you did it.
So yeah, hundreds of rules.
Hundreds. And I want to get into, first of all, you've talked about this, I know a lot, but I took away two things from this. One is you came to the conclusion that you can't take the Bible literally. It's impossible or you'll be a crazy person, okay?
That is so true. I agree with that. And I was a crazy person. I was living like, you know, as you say, I was throwing pebbles at adulterers from the, you know, and I looked like I had the ZZ Top beard, and, you know, I spend a lot of time at airport security. Yeah, you cannot take, and people who say they do take the Bible literally are mistaken, because they're just taking parts of it literally.
They're bearing false witness. They're lying.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I thought that one of the most profound things that I took away from the whole experiment in the book was, you say something that I never really thought about, but I guess I have thought about it indirectly. And you said, you know, we have this idea that if you change your mind, then you'll change your behavior. And in fact, you came to the conclusion that if you change your behavior, you'll change your mind. I really found that to be really profound to me.
Thanks. I mean, that has been for me the biggest takeaway. Yeah, if you want to be a better person, the secret is deception. You deceive yourself. You pretend to be a better person, and you become a little bit of a better person. Because one of the things was, in the Bible, it says no coveting, no lying, no gossiping. And I'm a journalist, and I live in New York City, so that's like my day right there. So I had to figure out, how do I do a moral makeover? And the secret was I pretended. I pretended to be a better person, and I became a little bit of a better person. You know, I'm no Gandhi. I still gossip and lie and covet a huge amount. But, you know, I've cut it down by a good, like, 40%.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the ongoing struggle as we get older. I mean, I feel that maybe the idea is, and I want you to talk about this, but if you read the great philosophies and the great mythologies, whether it's, you know, what the Buddha said or the Upanishads, or like, listen to me, I sound like I pore over the Upanishads. What I went through on my Upanishad stage. But any of the great wisdoms really concern themselves with self-restriction. And mastery over one's appetites. And I've always found that to be, you know, whether it's the Stoics, you know, whether it's Seneca or whether it's Aristotle or whether, you know, it's the Bible, that's kind of the central message. Gain control over yourself, gain control over the beast so that the spirit can expand. And you can put that in many different ways, but I always felt that there's got to be a great deal of truth in that.
Yeah, well, I've done a few experiments on that, and for me, that the key is that you gotta treat yourself like a lab rat. Like, I don't believe we have very much willpower, so I do everything in advance to try to stop the temptation. So, you know, those websites where they'll cut you off from the internet unless you reboot, I like to do that. You know, I put my cell phone, I hide it from myself in some other room. And at one point, I literally tied myself to my chair and so that I couldn't get up, because I tend to, when I'm writing, I get up every like 30 seconds to get like a bag of chips, and it's horrible. I get nothing done.
Yeah.
So I thought, why not do this? This is what Odysseus did in the Odyssey. He had his sailors tie him to the mast so that he wouldn't jump off into the sea when those
sirens,
the sirens
were calling his name. God, that's right.
So I thought, you know, I'll do what Odysseus did. I'll tie myself to my chair. And it worked. I mean, that was awesome.
Wow.
My wife came in and she's like, what the hell is going on? But
she's like, I didn't know that we were into this. What's our safety word? Strawberry?
Old Testament.
Yeah. Ezekiel.
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 Ezekiel. Oh, I'm so turned on right now.
Ezekiel, man, that guy was wild. That guy was crazy. I mean, first of all, he wanted to, he made Ezekiel bread, and the original recipe of Ezekiel bread is you have to cook all these grains over human poop, over poop.
Jeez.
You cook it in poop.
Really?
Yeah.
Does that mean I get to send back my loaf of Ezekiel bread because they didn't prepare it properly? It's
false
advertising.
Send them a note. Send a note and say, listen, this does not taste like fecal matter.
It doesn't taste like shit.
I want fundamentalist Ezekiel bread.
Yeah. Mm. But to be a better person, you've essentially got to lie to yourself, let's be honest. And
that's what I think. I still do it all the time. Like, you know, I wake up a lot of mornings like in total despair. You know, when I was writing the book about trying to be the healthiest person alive, I like woke up every morning. I said, oh, I'm never going to finish this. This is too big a topic. But I would pretend that I was confident. So I would call my publisher and say, oh, so when we have the party for the book release, you know, we should only serve healthy drinks like kale martinis. And he's like, okay. And if you pretend, after a couple hours of pretending that I was confident, my mind caught up with my actions. So I really think that is the secret.
Well, when you were trying to live as healthy as you could, what did you come away with? I mean, we're going to talk about what you came away with this idea of living biblically. But when you try to be really healthy, did you come up with a philosophy that you still follow?
Yeah, I mean, a few. One of the big things is that I still do. I wrote the book while walking on a treadmill, on those treadmill desks you might have read about, and so I still do that. And I am a big believer in that because. When I'm at my desk now, I tend to like fall asleep, and you can't do that when you're walking on a treadmill.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of those. And the other thing is just not stress is such an important part of being healthy, and you can get too stressed about your health. So that's what I did. I was like everything, every day I was doing thousands of things for your health, and that's not healthy. You know, you're going to die sooner if that's all you think
about. You see that a lot in L.A., where the object isn't necessarily you want to be healthy so you can do interesting things.
Totally, that's
right.
What I think.
Right, so you can live a life that's more fulfilling and practice your instrument longer, whatever it might be. But in L.A., you know, you find that health itself becomes the goal, right? So I just want to be the healthiest guy in the room. I want to be in the best shape. I want to be able to climb a rope 5 times in under a minute. And there's really no utility. When that becomes the reason.
There is utility, though. Mm. The utility is belonging and identity. It's the same reason why guys wear, like, you know, the far out outfits that they wear for their religions. They grow their weird beards. I mean, in L.A., like, that's what I always love is, you know, the Hasidim, right? They wear, like, these far out beaver hats and these giant coats, which make sense if you're living in Poland in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
But they're still wearing them on Pico in the middle of the Los Angeles summer. And it's just like you must be schwitzing.
Yeah.
There is no way that you are not sweating
buckets.
Maybe
that's how they keep so trim. Usually see Hasids are not very fat.
Yeah.
But I think you're right, though. I think it is a religion. I think you get a lot of. Exercise, you know, and there's a cult of personality. Oh, I got to go to this one.
CrossFit. CrossFit is
CrossFit's
a
big
hell
cult.
Of a community. I mean, that's
cult.
Listen, if you enjoy it, that's okay. I personally don't enjoy that, so I'm happy not to, you know, work out until I vomit.
Right. They are in the best shape I've ever seen. I mean, some of those CrossFitters are incredible, but at the end of the day, look, are you doing a sport or are you just, you work at the Gap and you're in better shape than anybody? I'm not sure.
Yeah, but Brian, do you know the sort of strength it requires to fold a t-shirt?
Listen, you're talking to a 47-year-old comedian who boxes and takes it seriously. I get into a ring and try to box people and I get punched in the face. That's clearly a hole I'm trying to fill. I don't know what's going on.
I think the interesting thing is we're all cult members. Like, that's the reality, whether it's the cult of writers or the cult of, you know, health freaks or the cult of, you know, people who think that they're fighters when they're not, you know.
Hey, hey,
I'm not, that's not you, Brian, because you're legit.
Thanks.
I'm really excited for your title bout.
I'll send you my videos, AJ. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's the thing. We all are, and it's the degree to which we are aware and honest about that. And the people who are like, no, I'm not a cult member. This is the truth. This is reality. Those are the people who are nuts. Like,
yeah,
once you,
I love that. That is so true. Acknowledging the sort of absurdity of a lot of this stuff takes a huge edge off of it. Because, as you say, if you're, you know, if you're a fundamentalist and you're like, this is the way, those are the scary people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing. You lived like a fundamentalist and a true fundamentalist. Talk a little bit more about, you know, do you feel like you belong to, you're a journalist, so you've got to stay as objective as possible. But did it did this experiment make you more religious?
Well, I saw that there are good things about religion. You know, there's the crazy stuff, but there's also good things. You know, there's belonging to a community and the idea of behaving in a good way, and I do like some of the rituals of Judaism. You know, there's lots of food, they like to drink. Becoming really religious in a traditional way, no, I don't do that. But I do see the good in religion. You know, it's a tool. It can be used for good or it can be used for bad. The key is, as you know, not to take it literally.
But isn't it, you followed essentially what seems like the Old Testament. The New Testament would be easier to follow, wouldn't it?
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, there's hardcore stuff in the New Testament, too. And Paul says that women cannot talk in church. So if you followed that literally, you know, all churches would have no women in the choir. They'd all be sitting silently. And also, there's Jesus's idea of forgiveness. And, you know, I always, when I forgive, but with an asterisk. I forgive like, all right, I forgive you, but I remember exactly what you did. And if I need to, I'm going to use it later against you.
My grandmother said, I forgive, but I don't forget. Yeah.
There you go. Exactly. But if you take Jesus literally, he's saying, you know, forgiveness, like wipe that slate clean. Oh, and then in the New Testament, there's also all this stuff from Jesus. If anyone needs anything and they go to you and ask for it, you have to give it to them. So if you follow that literally, like I could come up to you and say, can I have $10,000? And you'd have to give it to me, which would be great.
Well, he said the hardest. One of the things he talked about is just the hardest thing for a rich man is to give up all his everything he's earned and kind of walk the path of a humble and poor man, right?
Right. Yeah. And at one point he says, if you are asked and someone needs something, you got to give it to them. So I did. You know, I would. At one point, I did, and he talks about clothing the naked. I remember I did go, you know, the naked cowboy in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to the naked cowboy and offered him my clothes, and he was actually very nice. He tried them on, and he was very supportive.
Well, you're a sinner because he's got probably the best body I've ever seen in my life, and the guy stays perpetually tan, and he's built like a linebacker. He's got the best body for a naked cowboy, and so don't ever put clothes on him. And I'm a straight man saying this.
Well, he took them off, so you don't have to worry.
There you go. Now, did you feel healthier when you were living biblically?
Well, I did. I certainly felt happier. Like one thing that another good thing in the Bible was that they say you have to say thanks for everything. So I went crazy with that, and I would say thanks for everything in my day. I'd press the elevator button, and I'd be thankful the elevator came. I'd get in the elevator and be thankful it didn't plummet to the basement and break my collarbone. And this went, you know, hundreds of times a day, and it was weird, but it was also wonderful because you do realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day,
yeah.
And we tend to focus on the three or four that go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice radical change in perspective that I have tried to keep.
But the in terms of that, though, how else did that change your psychology? Because, you know, I mean, one of the interesting things in Martin Seligman's work, who is really the founder of the positive psychology movement, is that people who are optimistic are generally much, much more successful, but they're also much, much more delusional.
Yeah.
And so
I'm a big fan of delusion, as I say. I mean, I think that is important, you know, not crazy delusion like, you know, the CIA is in my brain, but optimistic delusion. I think we could not get anything accomplished without that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just you look at anyone. I think starting out as a writer, I had to be totally deluded because the odds are so stacked against. And I imagine the same thing in comedy. You got to be seriously deluded to keep doing this day after day when the odds of making it are so slim.
Unless you're the greatest of all time, which I'm not. I'm not trying to be cocky. I'm just very funny. But
Brian, is it true that there was a prophecy about you, about your coming?
I mean, if you read Comedy Magazine, that's what they say. Now, it's such an ambitious thing. When we had John Durant on.
Oh, I know John.
Yeah, great guy, and he wrote the Paleo Manifesto. And one of the things he talks about, and I'm sure you know, or maybe you talked to him, is that there were so many practical advantages to living biblically for the Israelites. Mainly, it was about keeping pathogens at bay. You bathed and you cleaned and you were obsessed with menstrual cycles and all these things. You didn't drink blood. The book of Leviticus talks about all the kind of foods you can't eat and how to prepare food. So much of that had to do really with science, with the idea that you were keeping bacteria out of your body or harmful bacteria and pathogens. When you kept clean, you
right.
had a better chance of living longer.
Well, I do think, you know, Jews have a higher percentage of obsessive compulsive disorder, and that probably was healthy back then, you know? If you're washing your hands 22 times a day, that's
probably... How many times did you have to bathe?
During that year?
Yeah.
Well, I had to bathe. You want to bathe, you have to bathe after sex. My wife was not having a lot of sex with me because of my beard, so that wasn't a problem.
She didn't want. She wasn't into broom service. she didn't. I never understood women who date guys with. I'll be doing stand up, and I look out in the audience, and it's just this guy with a giant beard, and it's just. I think to myself, that poor woman gets a mouth of hair every single time she makes.
I know.
That.
My wife was like, "This is not going to happen."
Yeah.
And she didn't. And, you know, I couldn't, as you mentioned, I couldn't touch her when she was menstruating. So, and if you take it really literally, you cannot touch a woman. If a woman who's menstruating sits on a chair, then that chair is impure and you're not supposed to sit on it. And my wife found this offensive. So she sat in every seat in our apartment. And
good on her.
To,
good on her.
That was smart, right?
Yeah.
And I had to, well, I will say this. I had to stand for the year, but then when I was doing my health book, I realized that's probably healthy. You know, sitting is the new smoking. It's really bad for you. So she was doing me a favor.
Wow. So standing, because I know several writers who are now standing at their desk.
Yeah. So the Onion did a great article on the new fetal position desks that you can work in a fetal position.
Really?
Well, it's a joke.
Oh. It is the Onion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian is working on a fecal position desk. Where you...
That's right. I don't want to move. I got no reason to sit down. Every time I try to write, I have the same problem. Tying myself to a chair sounds like a, you know, it's probably the only thing. My friend had such a morbid thought. He can't write, and he knows he's got a story in him. And he goes, I just sometimes wish I had an injury, and I had to sit in my chair for a year, and I would write. And I was like, talk about, you know, how badly we procrastinate. I always feel like all these religions and things, no matter how austere, it feels like that is human beings have a nostalgia, have an urge, a need to figure out how to control this animal inside of us.
Yeah. Well, I'm all into that. You're probably into the behavioral economics and how we have two parts. We've got the elephant, this crazy, like, system where we follow our urges and immediate gratification, and then we've got the rider on top of the elephant, mm-hmm. the little guy, the little monkey on top who's trying to control it.
Yeah.
So, I'm all for that, trying to control that elephant.
And that's Jonathan Haidt's analogy, who we interviewed and we're huge, huge fans of.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm a fan of his as well.
Yeah. And actually, I thought what he said about religion in particular, I mean, that's part of, you know, what I've been thinking about as I read your book was, you know, that the purpose of religion is... It's functional. It has an evolutionary adaptation, which is to bind people into groups. And then those groups can do far greater things than the individuals ever could.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Otherwise it wouldn't be around if it didn't have an evolutionary reason.
Well, and that's the thing is that people like Dawkins claim that, you know, religion is just some sort of weird artifact, that it's a mistake, that it's, you know, a virus or whatever. But it seems nuts that something that is such a part of human experience doesn't have some sort of function.
Right. But the question is, has it outlived its function or not? And I think, as I said, you know, religion can be used for good or it can be used for evil. And for me, it's not the difference between religion and non-religion. That, to me, is a mistake. I think the difference we got to do is fundamentalism versus non-fundamentalism, because you can have people who are not religious who are fundamentalists, like, you know, communism and fascism, and that was just as evil as religion at its worst.
But we're missing just a point. There's one thing to living biblically. There's another thing, and we touched on it before. When you can change your behavior, you change your mind. But when you talk about prayer or meditation, that's you know, a religious person, you know, if we had a rabbi here or a priest, I'm sure they would have a very different concept of religion. Sure, there are the physical externalities, but more importantly is something called that humble communion with your soul, the idea that there's something much bigger than yourself out there, that one has to reach for that, that one has to strive for understanding or at least communion with this thing called God.
But you don't need the supernatural to understand the benefits of that. I mean, you
right.
know, the benefits of meditation, for example, and mindfulness and all of that stuff, is now abundantly established by psychology and neuroscience and all of these sorts of things.
Maybe, but prayer has more to do. See, that the problem with that statement is also the idea that, well, this is the good it does for you. Actually, prayer and meditation, according to the very religious, should have an even bigger function. It should have actually, in many ways, nothing to do with you. It should have to do with God, with something very separate, especially if it's a Judeo-Christian ethic.
Right.
That would be then giving really respect and homage to this God that lives in the sky, because you worship for worship's sake. You humble yourself. You tremble before God. I think that's actually the root of the Hasidic.
But that's the feeling that's created. I mean, that's Haidt's work. It's all about that feeling of transcendence, about being lifted out of yourself, about it not being selfish, about you thinking about the group and all of these sorts of stuff.
And did that happen to you, AJ?
Yeah, I'm with Hunter on that. I mean, I did. I had to pray 5-10 times a day, even though I didn't believe in God, and I was doing it so much that I started to believe in God. And
wow.
So it really does. It does change your mind. At the end, when I stopped praying as much, I still give thanks, but I stopped praying. I stopped believing in God like I did. I'm what they call a reverent, the term is a reverent agnostic. So my feeling is, I don't know whether there's a God or not, but I love the idea of the sacredness, that there's something that, like, prayers of thanksgiving can be sacred, time with your family can be sacred, taking a day off a week, that can be sacred. And it's probable that humans created this sacredness ourselves. It just means something set apart. But I still like the idea of sacredness.
But go back for a second to say what you were talking about. As you prayed, you started to believe in God. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I had never prayed before in my life, but I had to every day, you know, say prayers from the Bible. And it's that idea again. It's like method acting. You get so deep into your character that you start to believe. And, yeah, so at times I was like, you know, there's got to be, how can there not be a God? There's all this, you know, if there is no God, then why does everything exist? But then I would sort of snap out of it. But it just proves how powerful that trick is, that if you act in a certain way, then you become that thing. And I still use it, as I say, I don't use it to believe in God, but I use it to become more confident or more compassionate.
But somebody, I wonder if somebody would say, well, I wonder how he was praying. Because what I'm thinking is, when you said you prayed 5-10 times a day, does that mean you were on your knees and just giving thanks? Or what does that mean? Because there are different ways to pray, right?
Yeah, the Bible has, there are many ways to pray. You can get on your knees. It actually never says you have to. Yeah, sometimes I like put my arms out, so I was like, you know, an antenna. You can do it sitting down. And I would often just recite passages from the Bible, or I would try to thank God. Yeah, I mean, it was weird. It was weird to be doing it since I'd never done it before. And sometimes I would get out of myself. I would transcend myself, and that's a lovely feeling. But I think Hunter is right. You don't need prayer to do that. You can do that with meditation.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, that's the thing. One of the things that Haidt talks about, which I think is so fascinating, is why do armies march? Like, why do armies drill people? Why do they force them to perform all of these maneuvers? And the whole point is that those rituals, that rhythmic marching, what it does is it removes the individual and binds you into a larger group.
Yeah.
And a lot of soldiers who come back from war, you know, part of the difficulty of integrating into society, it's the violence, it's all the things that they've seen, it's the things they've had to do. But it's also because they've felt that band of brothers, that sense of camaraderie and community, and that experience is a religious experience.
Dan Robinson, who we had on the show, who's a philosopher over at Oxford and Professor Emeritus at Georgetown University, talked about this. He said, men don't go to war. Freud said men go to war because they hate each other. And he said, I think he missed the mark. He said, men go to war for love. They go to war to defend a lifestyle, a way of life, but men march and go to war over symbols and propaganda, slogans, and what you just said.
For belonging,
which I thought was fascinating. I'd never really thought of that. But yeah, so in that sense, as sick as it sounds, that war, the ritual of war, can certainly be very similar to religions, putting on robes and going through that ritual.
Because it's the same emotional experience. And I think what AJ is saying about it's easier to act your way into a different way of feeling than it is to feel your way into a different way of acting. Mm. That's the point. Like, the ritual of praying, it doesn't even matter how you do it. You will end up believing. And then what happens is, and this is where Haidt's work becomes so important, is because you feel like God exists. And then you afterwards come up with an explanation for why, you know, AJ's experience is less real because he faked it, right? Oh, you're not praying in the right way. Oh, you're not doing it with a sincere heart and all that sort of stuff. And it doesn't matter. Just as you can fake your way into, you know, being a neat freak or, you know, being disciplined about writing, you can fake your way into believing in God and then legitimately feel like God exists.
Hmm. Well, that is actually, the Jews have a saying, deed before creed, and mm-hmm. that's the whole idea. You do all these deeds, and then you start to believe. And as I say, that has totally changed my life. You know, like during that year, the Bible year, I had a friend who was in the hospital and who was sick. I hate hospitals. I did not want to visit him, but I forced myself to visit. I said, what would a good person do? And I acted as if I was a good person. I went to the hospital, and I sort of tricked my mind. I saw, hey, I'm at the hospital. I must be a pretty compassionate person. And then you start to become a little more compassionate.
Hmm. Yeah, it's that's just assume the position, you know. Your behavior dictates and controls your mind. That's really what I took away from the whole experience. You know, we hear these things.
Yeah. We're on the same page then.
Yeah, we hear these things and it's hard to really, you know, it's hard to kind of just say that unless you experience it. It sounds like you had to go through the experience to really believe that.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't have to go grow an insane beard and throw pebbles at adulterers to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you can just do it on a small basis, like pretending to be cocky, pretending to have to not be afraid, and if you do that long enough, then you become less afraid.
Pretending that you love to do the dishes for your wife. You know what I mean?
let's not get carried away, Hunter.
That's nuts.
But actually, that was the other question I had. Did it make you feel? Did you feel braver? Did you worry less? Did stress go away? Did you feel less afraid of the insanity of the world?
Yeah, and that's one of the takeaways of all of these experiments, is that you should be bold and experimental. And I'm not. You know, I was born to be sort of reserved, even a little timid. But again, I just pretend to be bold, and it sticks. And I think it's made my life better. And not always, you know, it's been a disaster sometimes, but overall, it's made my life better.
I think that holy men, the reason that we kind of revere them is because in the back of our minds, or maybe the forefront of our minds, we've always looked at them and said, well, that guy is less afraid of death than I am. A priest has made his peace already with his maker. There's that famous story about the Buddhist and this great samurai is coming into the town, and he kills everybody unless they're bowing. They have their heads to the ground, and otherwise he'll slay the whole village. And of course the Buddhist is just standing there in his robes, and the samurai comes in and goes, "Do you not know who I am? I'm the man who can cut you into 100 pieces without batting an eye." And the Buddhist looks up to him and says, "Do you not know who I am? I am the man who can be cut into 100 pieces without batting an eye." I was like, oh, man, way cooler, way cooler. You know, and that seems to be, you know, at the end of the day, at least why we revere the great kung fu master, the priest, the holy man, the man of cloth. You know.
But it also, I mean, that's the thing. Again, it depends on what religion you believe in. Right? I mean, if your religion is CrossFit, then you revere the guy who can do 100 burpees.
Oh, but there's a difference. No, but there's a difference between what I think, and AJ, back me up or don't. CrossFit and so many of these things that we're calling religion are really about the, not only are they about the person and completely about the person doing them, they're also so physical and materialistic. Whereas when you try to follow something like the Old Testament, I feel like it's exactly the opposite. So much of when you try to walk the religious, the spiritual path, as you did, AJ, is it's really the objective is self-forgetfulness. The objective is true humility, isn't it?
Well, I think some parts of the Bible, yes, and some parts, no. To me, the Bible, you cannot say the Bible says X, Y, Z, because it's like the Wikipedia. It was written by hundreds of different people over thousands of years. So some parts are just like that, are very about, you know, love your neighbor, sacrifice, do unto others. And some parts are about getting what you could get, and if this, then you're going to get rich. Your cattle flock will grow if you follow these commandments. You're going to be rich and have 100 wives.
Right. Well, hey,
and
100 wives, man.
It's a lot to deal
with. Yeah, that was one thing about the Bible. You know, in the Old Testament, polygamy is just fine. All the great patriarchs had many wives. Solomon had 900 wives, which I don't know how he had time for that.
I would find time. Your wife must have loved you.
I don't know. That sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm too old. But I actually tried to get a second wife because I called the head of the American polygamy movement, and I was like, you know, it sounds like a good idea, but how do I go about it? And he said, well, the key is you got to do a preemptive strike. You don't ask permission. You just go out and get married to the second one and then come home and say, hey, guess what? I have, meet my new wife.
Good luck.
Oh, my
good
God.
Luck. Yeah, I'm sure a New York judge would really sympathize with A.J. Jacobs. He's like, dude, I'm writing a book. I wanted to get a little tail on the side.
It's research.
Yeah, I was going to say it's research, man. Yeah, I got a side piece, but it's research. Sorry about being so chauvinistic. Sorry about calling it a side piece. I meant a second wife. I apologize.
I don't know that that's any better. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's still pretty terrible.
Well, in Islam, you can have four wives, but you must treat all of them the same. I think that's a great...
And you have to support them.
Yeah, you have to support them and treat them all, I think, with equal affection and equal... I mean, so I love that because it's like, listen, man, if you think you got the energy and you got the cash, I actually don't know anyone. And I was pretty much an animal before I got married. I don't know anyone who has the ability to keep up with four wives equally. You know, I mean, that would be basically impossible.
No, that would be, I don't have the energy. Yeah, I mean, a lot of readers send me suggestions on what experiments I should do. And one that's a common is people said, you should try to be the greatest lover in the world and do all the positions in the Kama Sutra. And I'm like, I brought it up to my wife, and she's like, there is no way. There's no way we're going to. But I agree with her. Like, I don't think I could do it. I'm, you know, on my back. I don't think.
Yeah, just, I mean,
I'm not up for it.
I think so much of that stuff is, you know, it's almost like what I really, one of my favorite things about the Old Testament or the commandments is don't worship false gods, idolatry. Idolatry takes its form in many different ways, manifests itself in many different ways in our culture, and I don't think any of them are positive. Our worship of celebrity, as one of the big examples, and even our need and our worship of immortality, our need to stay as healthy as we can, as muscular as we can, to be having sex at 50 in all the different positions just to show ourselves that we still got it. I'm talking about myself, by
yeah.
the way. And that's a struggle I have all the time, this need to keep young. I mean, are you kidding me? Boxing at 47? It's
but I
so
think
sad.
I think so much of it is really, I mean, that's the thing. It comes back to knowing thyself, like really paying attention to what you want, what's going to make you happy long term and all that sort of stuff. As a side note, I want to write a book called The Kama Sutra, which is the two positions that people actually do.
Yeah.
It's going to be the shortest book ever written.
Doggy style missionary. I'm a fan
that's
of missionary.
It.
I'm a fan
and...
of missionary. Yeah. Keep all your bullshit reverse cowgirl yeah. crap. I can't do it. AJ, let's move on to your current experiment.
Yes,
and
which
that
could
is...
not have happened without the missionary position throughout. It's a good segue.
Good segue, brother. Good segue. Talk to us a little bit about this new project.
Well, this new project started because a few months ago I got an email out of the blue from a guy who had read my book, and he said, "You don't know me, but I'm your 12th cousin." And he said, "I have a family tree with 80,000 people on it, including you, Karl Marx, and a bunch of European aristocrats." And in my first reaction, as I think would be yours, this is a Nigerian scammer. He's going to ask me to wire $10,000.
Yeah.
And my second reaction was, well, if this is true, do I want 80,000 more relatives? I have enough trouble with some of the ones I've got.
Yeah.
I won't name names, but they know who they are. But then I started looking into it, and it was real. There is this genealogy, which I always thought was sort of staid and boring, is going through this crazy, wild revolution where because of the internet, you can combine your trees with your family tree with another tree. So if there's an A.J. Jacobs on one tree and an A.J. Jacobs on another, you sort of merge them. And so now there are these mega trees, and the biggest one I'm on is, it's insane, it's on a site called Genie. I'm 77 million relatives. I have
wow.
77 million relatives.
77 million?
Yeah, including, Jesus. You know, all friends from camp, and Gwyneth Paltrow's on there, Albert Einstein. It's not all good. I got Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh,
so that's
no,
through my
dude.
Wife. That's through my wife.
Oh,
through
yeah.
your wife.
Totes.
I'm going to blame it on her. But so that is, you know, it's just insane. And in a few years, we're going to have a family tree of all 7 billion members of the human family. So this old cliche, you heard as a kid, we're all one big family. Now it's come true. You can see how it is. And so I'm hoping, and it's a little hippy-dippy idealistic, but I think if once people see this, they might start treating each other a little more kindly. You know, we're not all going to be singing Kumbaya, but I think that it'll help reinforce how closely aligned we all are, and we share 99.9% of our DNA.
Did you do, speaking of DNA, did you do a swab of your cheek?
Oh, sure, I did all of those. And so you do that, and you send it off, and they send you a list of hundreds of cousins you didn't know you had. And one of them was very interesting, my wife. I am cousins with my wife, so that was exciting.
Nice.
She
nice.
Was not excited, but I thought it was kind of, we're distant, so
yeah.
no extra limbs on our kids or anything. But
yeah.
Yeah.
But we're not the excited, you know, you go back far enough, Everyone is married to, you're married to your cousin, because the farthest cousin you have on earth is about a 50th cousin. So when I found all this, I'm like, all right, what can I do with all these millions of relatives? And that's when I decided I'm going to hold a party, and you're invited. Everyone who's listening is invited. It's going to be the biggest, most inclusive family reunion ever. And it'll be like a family reunion meets Woodstock, meets a TED conference, and speeches and music. And
well, good luck with that, by the way, because you know it's everybody's pretty busy. But I'll do my best to attend. But when one of the things I thought was fascinating is they did this sort of genealogical experiment where they found that they isolated sort of this one tribe in Africa that we all share genes from, or one area at least. And so all of us, it seems to scientists that was sort of the cradle of human civilization, and then we branched from there. Then they took the DNA samples from a Hasidic tribe in, I think, Hungary, and found that they were very closely related, and more so than many other, including some American blacks, I think. I can't remember, but they were very closely. They shared a great deal of genetic material with this particular tribe. Do you remember that? Did you read anything about that?
I didn't read in that one, but that's interesting. I mean, it just shows that different groups that think they're so different are really, I mean, that's one of the things that's so exciting. Did you see they did a DNA test on some KKK neo-Nazi guy and found all of his African-American cousins, and he freaked out. Like, he was like, no way, no, you did it wrong. That's not true. Yeah. But it is true. There's no such thing as pure blood. That's a total myth.
Yeah.
We are all one big, we're all mixed together, and we're not even one species because, you know, we've got the Neanderthal genes in us. We've got, each of us has about 3% Neanderthal, which is a totally different species.
It's amazing how we just keep having sex with each other. And that's the bottom line.
Yeah, I'm all for it. Yeah. And it's just going to get more and more interwoven because, you know, now, with all of, you know, we're interbreeding between ethnic communities on an unprecedented scale.
Well, we always have, though. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the if you just pick up a history book, the amount of rape that it seems went on. The men would come into a city or a town or a village and knock down the walls, kill the men, and rape all the women.
That is true.
It's amazing. It's just the how bad it was to be a human being back in those times when you didn't know that Mongol horde that was coming over your walls to enslave your children and rape your women, etc. That seems to be how we really cross-pollinated.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully now we can do it in a
sexier way.
With Match.com.
Tinder,
it's true. We've always interbred.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, and it's all of those things. It's not that just that. There was, I remember reading something where there were these British explorers in the 1800s or the 1900s, and they were in some remote part of Nepal, and the locals, like, essentially asked these visitors to breed with their women to introduce genetic diversity, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Wow.
So, I mean, there have been that's the thing is that, you know, people have always tried to encourage that mixing in all sorts of ways. Some of it has been forced, some of it has been consensual. But yeah, absolutely. Now it's only going to happen. There's going to be more incest than ever. And some people say incest. I say wincest.
Wincest. I want to jump on that too. We'll close with this. By the way, the book we were talking about is The Year of Living Biblically. I don't know if I talked about that enough, but he also wrote another book. So he took a year to live biblically. But let's go back to this something else you did that I think is just amazing. You read all 32 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and then you wrote a book called The Know-It-All, One Man's Humble Quest to Become the Smartest Person in the World. That was in 2004.
That's true. That was my first big book. Yeah, that was a bizarre experience. And let me just do one plug for people who want to join the family and figure out how they're related to Obama and Gwyneth. They can go to globalfamilyreunion.com, and that'll tell you how to figure out how to be part of this family tree.
Globalfamilyreunion.com. You know, I'm sending you all my info because I want to see if my mother's.
I'm figuring out. Because as you mentioned before, you know, you think your mother thinks she might have some Jewish blood, so I'm going to get you in the tribe.
That's what I'm talking about.
You can call yourself a Jewish comic, finally.
Yes. Start wearing the Star of David, baby.
That's right. So I did that. I mean, that was partly because my dad, when I was a kid, he started to read the encyclopedia, but he didn't quite finish, made it up to the middle of the B's around Borneo or so. And I was like, you know what? Let me try to finish what he began and remove that black mark from our family history. So I did for a year and a half. I read for 8 hours a day. And, it was painful, but wonderful at the same time. I drove my wife crazy, you know.
You have the best wife, by the way.
She is a patient wife. Well, I will say I cut out the parts where she yells at me. I don't write about those.
Yeah.
And by the way, you read 8 hours a day before you knew to tie yourself to your chair, which is
that's true. Yeah. That is true. Yeah. I don't know how I did it. But it was my wife actually started to fine me, penalize me $1 for every irrelevant fact I inserted into conversation. So, you know, she'd say, I have such a headache. And I'd say, did you know that the Bayer Aspirin Company invented heroin, which is true. It was originally a cough suppressant, and it was very effective cough suppressant, but it had some side effects. These things happen.
Sure.
So anyway, that would be a dollar. And so I did it, and I've forgotten 98% of what I learned, but I did, like in all the other books, I took away some wisdom. So I do feel like I'm glad I did it, despite it being so crazy.
So you've done these crazy things. You lived biblically. You tried to become the smartest person in the world. You outsourced your life to India, which is hilarious to me. And so you continue to do these life experiments. You're very ambitious. Now you're trying to get the entire world together and show. And you want to basically show everybody, hey, we're all one big family. Can't we just get along?
That's it.
Yeah. And so I wonder, what have you come away with? A concrete philosophy. How are you going to raise your children? What are the principles you're going to try to put into your children? Curiosity, keep going. What is it?
That's it. Curiosity and experimentation. Mm. You know, not too much. I don't want them experimenting with heroin.
Yeah.
But moderate experimentation, because I really do think that makes for a better life. And you know, you've read probably all these neuroscience self-help books, and they talk about this. If you keep doing something in the same way, you create these ruts in your brain, these neural ruts, and it's just really healthy to try do something new, even if it's tiny, even if it's taking a new way to work or brushing your teeth with the other hand. It just it creates new connections in the brain. It allows you to be more creative. It allows you to be happier. So that's what I try to instill in them. You know, try new things.
Right. I love it. Well, there it is. I'm taking that away. I take that away from but thank you for doing all that work. And, and so I don't have to do it, but try new things. Stay uncomfortable, and you might get more comfortable.
That's it. I like that. I'm going to steal that.
There you go. Put that on your next book. God, I'm so smart. AJ Jacobs, you are a really interesting dude, man. Thank you for taking the time to do
it. My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yeah. You are interesting dudes as well.
Thank you. We like having you on the Mother of All Podcasts. Why don't we call it the Mother of All Podcasts, Hunter? And thanks, Hunter, for booking yet another fantastic guest. I see Hunter does all the work. I just show up. AJ, when I come to New York, come see my stand-up. I'll make you laugh.
I would love to.
All right, pal.
And you got to come to my reunion. Sister Sledge will be playing.
I love it. I'm telling you, and I'm not kidding, I'm going to email you all my info, and I want you to please help me find out who I am and where I come from.
Absolutely. I'm on it.
You're the best.
Thank you.
AJ Jacobs, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. The Year of Living Biblically and The Know-It-All, two very worthwhile books, very funny and very informative. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
There we are. Hunter, you got a little quiet at the end there. What happened?
Well, I'm just pensive, you know, Brian. I mean, you know, I've got a lot to think about.
You're just a pensive guy.
I love that.
Thank you very much. Well, that's our time. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. And, very quickly, I just want to say that I've gotten a lot of flack for the Paul Offit podcast, and I have been misrepresented on Reddit. There was a thread about the fact that I might have been talking about Joe Rogan and his vitamin company and Aubrey Marcus, and that is not true. Onnit is a very reputable company. It's an excellent company. It's a company whose products I have used and enjoyed. And I happen to know for a fact that Aubrey Marcus and Joe Rogan are very ethical people that put only in their products what they believe and what they've researched. So don't imply things and start threads. Do me a favor and email me at briancallan@gmail.com first, or tweet me and ask me a question and I'll set you straight. The internet is unbelievable, man. It's unbelievable. If you have a discussion about something, if you start raising questions, be ready for people to misinterpret, because we always talk about this. People have strong opinions. I do. We all do. And we develop a belief system and a philosophy around something because it works for us. And if you start to challenge that, even with questions, you'll get people who come at you and they're not really listening. What they do is they feel threatened immediately, and then they'll start deciding that you are saying something that you're not. And that was the first experience I've had. There was a thread on Reddit about me going bad on Aubrey and Joe Rogan. Of course I didn't. Wasn't even talking about them. I was approached by a vitamin company, a supplement company. They wanted to sponsor this podcast. What I said to them was, I can't sponsor anything unless I have seen double-blind studies that prove its efficacy. Is that the word?
Efficacy.
Efficacy. And that's just the way it is. I can't get behind something. I wouldn't allow Coca-Cola to sponsor this podcast because I don't believe in the product. I just don't drink it.
And the point is that Coca-Cola, you know, is bad. Vitamins, you don't know. But, you know, Paul Offit is an incredibly reputable doctor.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of studies that have been done about this stuff. And I think that's the thing.
Sure. And by the way, I don't know if vitamins in certain dosages are good or bad for you. I don't know. I don't take them personally. So it'd be very hard for me. But I do know people who are very smart who do, and who have a lot of information to suggest that maybe they are good for you in certain doses. I'm not going to get into that argument. I'm not a scientist. I don't do that kind of research. And maybe so. But I'm not. All I was saying was that I'm not. I couldn't, in good faith, take someone's money who has a product that I'm not sure about. That's all it was, and I never will. You know. Anyway, it was a pretty fascinating experience, and it happened yesterday. And I addressed it on Reddit. I don't really believe in getting involved in the internet, but when something I said might have a detrimental effect on a good friend of mine's company, and that company is a company I believe in and I think is a good company, and I know the people involved in the company are good people. Genuinely good people and smart people who really believe in their product because they do the work. I have to say something, so that's what I'm doing now. But it was pretty surprising to me, and I guess we're becoming very powerful as a voice.
It's true, Brian. I actually heard that the U.S. government was thinking about recognizing us as the sixth estate.
What?
What?
What? Ladies and gentlemen, I'll see you later. Thank you so much. I gotta go into hiding.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.